The headlines: Israel targeting an area near the Syrian capital with missiles. Sebastian Piñera surviving an impeachment bid. Chile Senate votes against removing the president over corruption allegation. Plus, new lockdown measures go into force in Delhi to tackle dangerous levels of air pollution. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Israel has launched two missiles targeting an empty building in the south of the Syrian capital, Damascus. Earlier, we were joined by our Damascus correspondent, Mohammed Ali, who gave us the latest about the attack.
So, Syrian state news media reported that at about 12:45 a.m. local time here in Damascus, Israel carried out an attack firing two missiles targeting south of Damascus, an area south of Damascus. The state news media outlets did not confirm if those missiles were surface-to-surface missiles or if they were fired from an Israeli fighter jets. However, the direction of the enemy missiles were from the occupied Syrian Golan over there. Of course, according to the media reports, official media reports here, the two missiles, one of the two missiles hit an empty building south of Damascus, while the other was intercepted by Syrian air defenses. Still, there is no official statement that came out from an official military source here or from the foreign ministry yet. Usually, a statement comes out from an official source. We have to wait and see what will come out, if any more details would be disclosed. However, it's definitely not the first time. Almost every week or two, Israel carries out an attack targeting Syrian army positions, whether around the capital Damascus in Syria's south or even in Homs countryside and in the Syria's northeast. Definitely not a surprise for the Syrian army. Israel's an enemy. Usually, the foreign ministry sends letters to the United Nations calling on the international body to shoulder responsibility in forcing Israel to respect sovereign countries and the independence of countries.
People have held a protest in the Gaza Strip to voice their anger at an agreement between the U.S. and the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees. Ruba Shabat has more from Gaza.
Politica factions in the Gaza Strip, along with the Joint Committee for Refugees, gathered in front of the UNRWA office in the Gaza Strip to reject the framework agreement signed between the United States and the agency regarding the restoration of U.S. funding for the UNRWA. The demonstration comes in conjunction with the International Conference for UNRWA, where several donor countries are scheduled to convene in Brussels under the chairmanship of Jordan and Sweden to discuss resuming the financial support to the UN agency and the Palestinian Authority.
We are holding this press conference based on our Palestinian people's demands all over the world. At the same time, the International Conference for UNRWA is being held in Brussels. UNRWA has been suffering from a critical impasse, and the victims of the shortage of aid are the poor Palestinian refugees. We are all united in expressing that we won't give up our right of return, and we have been calling for this right for 73 years. The international community is now in front of the real test whether to be committed to its conventions or not.
The framework for cooperation between the UNRWA and the U.S. for 2021-2022 calls for restoring U.S. funding to the UN agency after it was cut off for several years under former U.S. President Donald Trump. It includes that the U.S. will not make any contributions to UNRWA except on the condition that UNRWA ensures that no part of the U.S. contribution is used to assist any refugee receiving military training as a member of the Palestinian Liberation Organizations.
We are calling the donor countries to support the issue of Palestinian refugees that was founded basically by U.S. UNRWA has been the only witness for all the violations of Palestinians' rights, and the international community should maintain a long-term and sustainable fund to support Palestinian refugees until they gain their freedom. This is a systematic conspiracy to demolish the issue of Palestinian refugees.
UNRWA provides services, especially in health and education, for more than 5.5 million Palestinian refugees. Palestinians say that UNRWA must remain committed to its duties until their right of return is guaranteed. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Syrian and Russian high-ranking officials have held a follow-up conference in Damascus on refugees' return, discussing measures taken by both countries in the past years for encouraging Syrians who left the war-torn country to safely return back. Our correspondent Mohamed Ali has the details.
The joint conference of Syrian and Russian committees formed last year on Syrian refugees' return was held in Damascus. Syria's Minister of Local Administration said amnesty decrees and investment laws issued by Syria proves the government's genuine desire for refugees to come back. Officials said hundreds of thousands of refugees returned in the past years.
We formed two committees from Russia and Syria for implementing steps for refugees' return. Over 2 million displaced Syrians returned so far. Nearly 1 million of them came from foreign countries. There are 13 border crossings fully ready to receive refugees. Return of displaced resulted in dismantling 26 temporary shelters this year.
Syrian foreign ministry officials asserted that the government continues to repair the infrastructure and restore basic services to areas liberated by the Syrian government from terror, noting to some obstacles in the face of refugees, such as U.S. and Turkish occupation of Syrian soil, support to terrorist groups, and looting natural resources.
The Syrian government continues to take all measures for Syrians' return. Our efforts are faced by some conspiring countries' attempts to take advantage of the refugees' issue politically and exercise systematic misleading campaign that the situation is unstable, as well as lies that refugees are in danger if they return.
Russian President's special envoy told Press TV that the West started to realize they should shift their policy towards Syrians' repatriation.
Western countries were doing everything possible, and there was huge information and campaign against what has been done here, you know, and they were trying just to convince everybody that the conditions are not ready for the Syrian refugees to return. It comes to this, to the understanding of the Western countries that they have to start to be more active themselves now. I think that's a good start. It takes, they need time, of course, because they cannot just change completely their policy.
11 agreements and one contract have been prepared to be signed between Syria and Russia in the fields of education, medicine, culture, science, and industry. The gradual restoration of relations between Syria and the Arab world, as well as the enhancement of economic ties with the country's neighbors, constitute a spark of hope for all Syrian refugees that their homeland started its journey of recovery from war, a fact that represents a solid encouragement for their return. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
In Chile, an impeachment process against President Sebastián Piñera is now over, with the Senate declining to remove him despite a lower House vote last week over corruption allegations. Senators needed at least 29 votes in favor of impeachment, but they only got 24. The lower House of Congress approved the impeachment trial last week. Piñera is accused of using his presidency for business gains following the Pandora Papers leak recently. The documents reveal the offshore transactions of major political figures. According to those papers, Piñera has sold a mining company using a tax haven, but he denies the allegation. This was the second attempt to remove the president. The first one failed in 2019 over a crackdown on anti-government protesters. The drama for Piñera comes just days before Chileans will head to the polls to choose his successor. The U.S. Treasury Secretary says the government could be running out of money by mid-September. In a letter to lawmakers, Janet Yellen encouraged Congress to raise or suspend the United States debt ceiling as soon as possible in order to avoid a default. This comes as President Biden is seeking congressional approval for his climate and education spending plan, which amounts to $1.8 trillion. Republicans are opposed to the so-called Build Back Better plan. Back in October, the party also resisted raising the government's debt limit, almost causing the U.S. to default on its loans for the first time in history. Economists warned such an outcome would cause a catastrophic financial crisis. When speaking to our Washington correspondent, Colin Campbell, he says, with the holiday season around the corner and next year's midterm elections in sight, the government needs to fix the debt crisis sooner than later if it wants to avert the consequences.
Obviously, if the U.S. hits the debt ceiling without any type of amelioration, any kind of fix, This is bad for the credit rating for the U.S. This could put people on furlough. This is definitely not the predicament that the Biden administration would want to be in heading into 2022. One reason is the holidays. You don't want more people with economic woes and professional woes heading through the holiday season. Not only that, it's cold, so you have weather. You don't want people to be homeless. But then think about politically. 2022 is midterm elections. The Biden administration is already facing a very low approval rating, vice president even lower. Congress has all been consistently low, and it's run by Democrats right now. If these approval ratings continually head into 2022 and a few months into 2022 with low approval ratings, it's not good news for Democrats. And so this could put the Biden administration in political peril if that debt ceiling isn't raised.
A Venezuelan envoy has, or rather was, arrested last year in the African island of Cape Verde on a U.S. arrest warrant. Alex Saab was extradited to the United States last month to face trial and corruption allegations. We reached out to his wife, Camilla Fabri, to hear more about Saab's condition. She's very critical of the way her husband was treated by the Cape Verde government.
The experience of him in Cape Verde was horrific, horrible, and he was tortured every single day, not only physical, but also psychologist torture. And also, Alex is a survivor of cancer. The government of Cabo Verde never authorized the access of his medical of medical specialist to see him.
Fabri says the treatment came despite calls by international organizations to release Saab or stop his extradition. She says that Saab was an envoy on a humanitarian mission and his political immunity had to be respected by the Cape Verde government, was ignorant of all that and preferred to collaborate with the U.S.
They always claim the freedom, but at the end they are nothing more than a vassal of United States. They always follow the instruction of United States.
Fabri believes this was all set up to pile pressure on Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to oust him from power. On Monday, Saab pleaded not guilty in a federal court in the U.S. after a judge dropped several money laundering charges against him. He's now facing a single charge. Caracas calls Saab's detention a kidnapping case. It has also suspended the talks with the opposition on ending the political crisis in Venezuela. Saab was a member of that negotiating team. Their final destination is the United States, but for now this migrant caravan consisting of more than 1,500 people is stopping in a Mexican state. Based on some estimates, the number is much higher. Veracruz is the third state the caravan is crossing on its way to the northern border with the U.S. Mexican authorities say foreign national migration cards are issued for the caravan members to ensure they can work in Mexico as long as their activities are legal. The caravan with a large number of women and children set off from the country's south last month. Washington has been pressuring Mexico to contain them. Mexico says it's not blocking their progress, but is asking the migrants to use their documentation to stay in the country. While Delhi is enforcing a full weekend lockdown in order to deal with air pollution that's soaring to deadly levels, schools and colleges will have to remain closed. Construction activities are halted, and lorries are banned from entering the city. Most people will also work from home. 5 coal-fired power plants near the capital, New Delhi, will also stop working. The pollution levels in Delhi are 20 times higher than the acceptable levels set by the World Health Organization. Farmers burning their crop residue in winter also have a big role in polluting the air. And the drop in temperatures worsens the situation. India is home to more than two-thirds of the world's most polluted cities. In Delhi alone, over 17,000 people lost their lives because of air pollution 2 years ago. The coronavirus vaccine rollout is in full swing in Iran. The country now says the number of administered jabs has surpassed 100 million. Over 43 million people are fully vaccinated. That makes up for 60% of the target population. Iran was among the hardest hit countries in the region, but thanks to large-scale imports of COVID shots and the domestic production, it has now managed to bring the pandemic under control. Over 6 million people have so far been diagnosed. 128,000 others lost their lives. At least one person dies in torrential rains and ensuing mudslides in Canada's western province of British Columbia. Canadian police say they've recovered the body of a woman near the Lillooet community north of Vancouver. There are fears that the fatalities will rise. Rescue operations are underway for at least two missing persons. The rains that have been pouring since Friday let up on Tuesday, but floods, mudslides, and debris have blocked roads to Vancouver, trapping hundreds of motorists and sweeping their cars off the road. All rail access to the Port of Vancouver, which is Canada's largest, has also been cut. The incident is threatening the shipment of grain and coal across the country. A Muslim speaker and activist has won a legal battle against the British government back in 2015. He was smeared by the government as an extremist and hate preacher. Robert Carter reports from London.
A victory has been recorded in the battle against the state-backed Islamist extremism narrative after the British government admitted defeat in a lengthy legal battle against a smeared Muslim activist. In a statement read out in open court, Home Secretary Priti Patel apologised to Dr. Salman Butt, chief editor of Muslim website Islam21C, after he was wrongly branded an extremist hate preacher in a 2015 press release by the then Prime Minister David Cameron. Speaking to Press TV, the doctor explained his joy at winning the long and costly five-year battle for justice.
Yeah, it's not just a victory for me, and it's a victory not just for even all Muslims, but everyone. I said very early on in this case, and we've been saying it for years, ever since this nebulous term kind of cropped up into public discourse, that this is going to get used against more and more people. If history has shown us anything, is that when governments get the taste of arbitrarily restricting some people's speech and ideas, that circle of inexpressible opinion is going to get wider and wider and wider.
The win sets a new precedent, ensuring that Muslim freedom of speech is better protected and Muslims can win in court if smeared.
It's very important that the Muslims in the UK in particular, we take an empowering lesson from this and just don't engage with a structurally racist system of counter-extremism, which is painting their normal beliefs and practices as somehow suspect.
The doctor's work involves lecturing, defending Islamic opinions, and platforming Muslims. His win means he can continue his work with a clean reputation.
The significance of this story remains very deep, despite the fact that it probably didn't receive the press coverage that it deserved. Going forward, Islamophobic speakers who advocate against Muslims' right to freedom of speech may think twice before smearing speakers or Muslim organizations as being extremists going forward. Robert Carter, Slough.
That's a wrap for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Israel, as policy, fully supports and assists settler intimidation tactics that often result in the loss of Palestinian farm and pasture land, says Israeli rights group. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by the staff of Middle East Eye. This article is titled, "The Zionist Regime Uses Settler Violence as Tool to Take Palestinian Land." Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime has been using settler violence as a major informal tool to take over Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank, a leading Israeli rights group has found. Bethlehem, in a report released recently, said that Israel uses two main methods to confiscate Palestinian land in the West Bank: official annexation via its judicial system and unofficial acts of intimidation and violence carried out by settler population. The state fully supports and assists these acts of violence, and its agents sometimes participate in them directly, the Israeli rights group said in its report. As such, settler violence is a form of policy aided and abetted by official authorities with their active participation. According to the report, Israeli settlers have taken over 11 square miles of farm and pasture land in the occupied West Bank during the past 5 years. Using 5 case studies to illustrate how continuous systematic violence meted out by settlers is part of the Israeli regime's official policy. Bethlehem said Israel is using settler violence to drive a massive takeover of Palestinian land. One of the case studies documented an illegal outpost known as Ma'on Farm, which was erected illegally in the southern West Bank and consists of about 1 square mile of land. Settlers have harassed, beaten, and otherwise intimidated the Palestinians that have historically used the land for pasture and farming, resulting in confiscation. Juma Rabi, a 40-year-old shepherd from Al-Tawani village, told Bethlehem that settlers had been, for years, working to push his family off the farming that sustains them. In 2018, settlers attacked and beat Rabi, leaving him with severe injuries. He told the rights group, "They broke my leg and I had to spend 2 weeks in hospital and continue treatment at home. I had to sell most of our sheep to cover the cost of treatment." According to Bethlehem, Israel legitimizes settler violence both by legalizing their informal land grabs and by failing to even attempt to prevent or prosecute such violence. Bethlehem found the military avoids confronting violent settlers as a matter of policy, although soldiers have the authority and duty to detain and arrest them. As a rule, the military prefers to remove Palestinians from their own farmland or pasture land rather than confront settlers, using various tactics such as issuing closed military zone orders that apply to Palestinians only, or firing tear gas, stun grenades, rubber-coated metal bullets, and even live rounds. It continued, "Sometimes soldiers actively participate in the settler attacks or look on from the sidelines." Muayyad Besharat, programs and project manager at the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, told Middle East Eye that settler attacks against Palestinians have increased this year, particularly during the olive harvest season, which runs between October and November. The olive harvest is a lifeline for some 80,000 to 100,000 Palestinian families in the occupied West Bank. This year's season has been the hardest in recent memory, according to Beshara, who accompanies farmers during harvest as an observer. Echoing Bethlehem's report, Bisharat underlined the difficulty Palestinians face in attempting to combat settler attacks and land grabs, given the frequency in which settlers are accompanied by army escorts. While Palestinians regularly document and report settler attacks, both legally and via tools such as books, research reports, and documentaries, the Israeli regime almost never takes legal action against settlers. Israel's inaction continues after settler attacks on Palestinians have taken place, with enforcement authorities doing their utmost to avoid responding to these incidents, Bethlehem wrote, adding, complaints are difficult to file, and in the very few cases in which investigations are in fact opened, the system quickly whitewashes them. Indictments are hardly ever filed against settlers who harm Palestinians, and when they do, usually cite minor offenses, with token penalties to match in the rare instance of a conviction. The group found, in all, the lack of action has translated into de facto approval. It said, state violence, official and otherwise, is part and parcel of Israel's apartheid regime, which aims to create a Jewish-only space between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. The combination of violence, nominally unofficial violence, allows Israel to have it both ways, maintain plausible deniability and blame the violence on settlers rather than on the military. The courts or civil administration while advancing Palestinian disposition. The facts, however, blow plausible deniability out of the water. When the violence occurs with permission and assistance from the Israeli authorities and under its auspices, it is state violence. The settlers are not defying the state, they are doing its bidding, it said.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran's President Raisi says that the Islam Republic is serious about talks aimed at securing the rights of Iranian people by removing all sanctions imposed on the country. Negotiations between Iran and the P4+1 is slated to be kicking off in Vienna on November 29. Tehran wants the party that left the deal, that is the United States, to lift anti-Iran sanctions and offer guarantees not to scrap the deal again.
Vienna talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are only 2 weeks away. But U.S. President Joe Biden has so far refused to return his country to compliance with the accord or remove Washington's unilateral sanctions on Tehran. That despite the very fact that the UN-endorsed deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, was reached during his vice presidency. Iran has times and again stressed that the removal of U.S. sanctions in a verifiable manner is the main agenda of the upcoming talks. Tehran also says that it is ready to reach a good agreement during the Vienna talks, but not at any price. President Ebrahim Raisi says his government is serious about the talks that should aim to secure the rights of its people by removing all sanctions. Iran's stance is echoed by Russia. During a phone call with Raisi on Tuesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin reaffirmed his country's support for nuclear rights of the Iranian nation and the removal of sanctions. Also last week, the Russian foreign minister said his country would seek the full implementation of the JCPOA in the Vienna talks. Sergei Lavrov also called on the U.S. to honor its obligations, which include lifting all sanctions on Tehran. Also on Monday, deputy foreign ministers of China and Russia, during a virtual meeting with their Iranian counterpart, stressed that Washington's unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA and its sanctions are the main obstacles to the implementation of the accord. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the accord in 2018 and reimposed all the anti-Iran sanctions that had been lifted under the deal. Iran waited for a year to see if the European signatories could salvage it. But the European inaction prompted the country to begin gradually scaling back some of its commitments under the JCPOA. Now the current U.S. president says Washington will return to its compliance with the deal if Tehran does the same. The Islamic Republic stresses that it was the U.S. that abandoned the deal and must take the first step toward its revival by removing sanctions. So far, the actions taken by the Biden administration contradict its words that it wants to return to the accord. Last week, for instance, Biden encouraged other countries to stop purchasing Iran's oil. Experts believe Washington's withdrawal from the JCPOA, as well as its failed policies globally, have damaged its credibility.
I think the Biden administration, in spite of Mr. Trump's withdrawal from JCPOA, certainly undoing that may do Mr. Biden some good, but I think, unfortunately, Washington's credibility has been damaged, not just because of the JCPOA, but all these other accords that some people in Washington, especially the last occupant of the White House, thought or assume we can just walk in and walk out of.
No matter what happens in the upcoming talks in Vienna, but one thing is clear, though. Washington's influence in West Asia is waning. The U.S. and its Western allies have already failed in their plot to topple Syria's President Bashar al-Assad, despite years of backing they provided to terrorist groups there. In Yemen, U.S. logistic and military support for years-long Saudi war have failed to bring the Yemeni people to their knees. And the U.S. hasty withdrawal from Afghanistan recently proved it spent billions of dollars of taxpayers' money on the futile war.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Behrouz Najib, and today we're discussing JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. Let me introduce our guests in this edition. Editor of the Veterans Today, Mike Harris, joining us out of Phoenix, Arizona. Also with us, we'll have political commentator and peace activist Brian Taro from Malloy, Idaho.
Is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to the Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome, gentlemen, both to the show. Let me turn to Phoenix. Mike, Iran officials have stated that clearly that their intent on serious talks in Vienna aimed at sanction removal. What about Washington? Is it serious?
That remains to be seen. One has to realize that sanctions are really a very soft form of warfare intended to weaken the targeted country. And as long as sanctions are in place, Iran or any other country, Russia, for instance, has to be wary that the intention of country imposing the sanctions, in this case the USA, is to weaken them over the long term by denying them, you know, expendable products and parts and other things that that help sustain an economy and help sustain a country. And so if Washington was truly serious about this as a gesture of good faith, they should at least begin removing the sanctions, perhaps in a phased manner that would allow the Iranian government to gain some confidence that Washington is indeed sincere in their talks about reinstating the JCPOA and coming to some sort of an accord.
Right. Now, Brian, there are contradictory words and actions, and they make you wonder what exactly the White House is after. You know, they want Iran to go back to the negotiating table, so why do they impose fresh sanctions instead of removing the previous ones, like just Mike referred to? And is the U.S. sending the right signal this way?
No, it's not, and I would disagree on a slight thing with our with the other speaker that sanctions are not a soft form of warfare. It's a very deadly form of warfare, and it's a matter of life and death. And there are people who are dying who don't need to die because of these sanctions. It's a very aggressive and very violent. It is a form of warfare, yes, but there's no such thing as any soft warfare. But I don't think it's in the interest of the U.S. to have have an agreement here. It's in the interest of the U.S. or the people of the United States and our stated objectives, but it is not in the interest of the military-industrial complex, which really is the driving force in this country. Peace breaking out, in the words of the CEO of Raytheon Corporation, is something to be avoided, and he's hoping that that the Middle East will remain a place of positive growth in the coming years.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mike, apart from the optics and the rhetoric, do you see any change between the performance of the past and current U.S. administrations when it comes to dealing with a so-called maximum pressure campaign and sanctions against Iran?
Well, I don't see them having any effect at all. One of the things that the sanctions has done anywhere that the U.S. applies them long term is they force the country that's being subjected to the sanctions to develop their own in-country supply chains and become more self-reliant. So truly they're making the country stronger and not dependent upon international trade or international goods. Right. So they're making a more self-reliant, more resilient country rather than weakening them, because anything that can be done over in another country can also be done internally to the country that's being sanctioned. So this has been very noticeable in Russia, and is also noticeable in Iran because of the manufacture of pharmaceuticals and other things that's been occurring that have been withheld from these countries. So sanctions are really self-defeating. They're damaging in the short term, but in the long term, they create a more self-reliant country. So the U.S., what they're doing doesn't work. The U.S. State Department is broken. They've had misguided policies. They've been misguided since 9/11 broke out and this whole war on terror thing. Their previous guess was correct that the war machine likes to be fed, and they're hoping to keep this stirred up. But there's a better approach to this, and that is, what is the source of the animosity that the U.S., Israel, and a lot of the West has against Iran and against Russia? Are they just looking for the next victim to plunder, to create a war, or is there a deeper underlying cause? And once these questions are answered, we'll have a better view into what the real motivation is of the U.S. And so if we're going to talk that the Iran give up nuclear weapons, why not have the Middle East give up nuclear weapons? In fact, the entire world give up nuclear weapons, because Israel has a very robust nuclear program and nobody discusses it. And the U.S. is violating its own laws that says that they can't give aid or can't do commerce with any country that's not a member of the non-proliferation treaty, but yet Israel has more influence over the U.S. Foreign policy than the American citizens do.
Exactly, and the U.S. has used a bomb against people in Japan. Iran never initiated any war. Okay, Brian, I wanted you to draw a comparison, if there can be, any comparison between the present U.S. administration and the previous one when it comes to sanctions and all that pressure on Iran. Any change?
No, I think your previous question about what, aside from optics and rhetoric, is the difference. You take that away, and there's no question anymore. You can't talk about it anymore. But I think it's right that we need to focus on whenever there's a proliferation of weapons or threat of proliferation, rather than look at the new countries coming along, look at the fact that, as our friend said, with Israel, we have plausible deniability. Israel's a huge nuclear force in the area, and because we can't talk about it, they get to have the threat of using nuclear weapons without having the accountability. And we're violating these laws all the time. The United States is presently in the taking part in a $1 trillion, more than $1 trillion program to modernize our nuclear weapons. And in 2019, there was a report by the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States that said nuclear weapons could have decisive results for restoration of strategic stability and create conditions of how commanders can prevail in combat. So if for these past decades we've not had a nuclear war because the very fact that it's unthinkable, that the results would be, everyone would lose and there's no winner in a nuclear war, well, the United States is now putting a lot of money into the idea that a nuclear war can be won. And if we're looking at the threat of nuclear proliferation, we need to look at the United States first. And if any talk about sanctions, I'm saying this as an American too, that sanctions ought to be brought against the country that is driving this race and in nuclear weapons and provoking hostilities, in Iran, in the South China Sea, on the border with Russia. These are provocations that are going on daily.
Okay. Now, Mike, as you know, Tehran embarked on marathon talks with world powers, eventually signed the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. It did remain in full compliance as endorsed by the IAEA until more than a year, and that was after the U.S. left, more than a year after the President Trump pulled his country out of this deal and reimposed sanctions on Iran. So how can Iran make sure this time around that the U.S. won't renege on its commitments under a new administration and won't scrap the deal again?
Well, as long as the State Department remains in its current form and our Defense Department remains in its current form, you cannot trust the USA at all. Our country is run by gangsters, and it has been for some time. Any promises, any treaties that the U.S. Gives aren't worth the paper they're written on. And we as American people have seen the betrayal of our own government against us and the social contract we have with them via our Constitution. They're running roughshod over us right now. And so our government is not to be trusted. It is run by gangsters. And it's time for regime change within the U.S. and to restore ourselves to a more constitutional republic that respects the will of the people. As it is now, there's more foreign influence, has greater influence over U.S. foreign policy than the American people do. We have lost our voice, and we're being taken for granted, and our form of government, the constitutional republic, is a joke among us American people. We don't believe in the process anymore. Mm-hmm. And so the primary reason to have nuclear weapons, as Brian, the previous guest, said, is to deter any sort of warfare. And it's such dangerous thinking for the U.S. to think they can win a nuclear war, which is an unwinnable proposition. It is just insanity to do that. We had the MAD doctrine for a number of years with the Soviet Union, where both parties were afraid to engage in a nuclear war, fearing the devastation. Well, bad thinking within the Defense Department, the State Department, has gotten people thinking that they can possibly win this. They're going to end humanity on this planet. And that's not what we're here for. We're here to let's redeploy the war machine and let's turn it into a war from a war machine into a space exploration and development machine. There's far more profit out there than there is blowing up all life on this planet. Right. And it's time that I don't care if Iran has a nuclear weapon. The only reason to have one is to keep other people from invading you. And the U.S., through its behavior since 9/11, has proven to the world that they're not afraid to go in and just wreak havoc. They don't win wars. They go in and destroy countries. There's a big difference between that. And the U.S. is completely unjustified as foreign policy, and shame on our government and the gangsters that run it.
Now, Brian, when it comes to matters of trust and Iran asking for a guarantee, it's, you know, because of things like U.S. Senator Ted Cruz threatening that any future Republican president would tear a deal with Iran. And also we had President Biden just recently telling world countries not to buy Iranian oil, to just keep, sanctioning the country. Are these signs of good faith or bad faith in negotiations? And then they're pushing Iran to go to the negotiating table.
No, it's totally in bad faith, and it's what Ted Cruz is saying, and others would agree with them, I'm afraid, is the United States, as Mike said, is not the treaties we sign are not worth the paper they're printed on, and it makes it entirely incoherent if the next administration can deny these things. In the United States Constitution, there's the Supremacy Clause, the sixth article of the Constitution, not that that's worth all that much anymore, says that any treaty that the United States enters into and is ratified is the supreme law of the land. So when the United States is violating these treaties, it's violating international law, and it's violating U.S. law, too, and it's undermining as the other guest said, the confidence that anyone can have in the United States government, both foreign and domestic.
Right. Now, Mike, let's talk about Europe, the European side of the Iran nuclear deal. They failed to make good on their promises, of course, under pressure from the U.S., and they didn't keep their own commitments. Later on, they came with their own proposal, a 12-point thing. They didn't live up to that either. So any sign they will this time around?
Well, they're waiting for the U.S. to make a move. The U.S. has really got Europe under its thumb to a great degree, and Europe needs to act independently with or without the U.S., but the pressure doesn't come only from the U.S., but from the global banking cartel, if you will. Mm-hmm. And any country that doesn't play ball and follow this line of hostility against Iran and against Russia and against any other country that is not part of the global banking system, integrated to it and subservient to it, doesn't get treated very well and is portrayed in our media as a pariah state. And so until these things can be addressed and until parity can be brought back, and the voice of the people can be heard over the financial interest of the banks and big business, the war machine, et cetera, we're not going to get very far. And it's time, as I said before, it's time for regime change in the U.S., and it's time for us to restructure our global economy in a manner that is more egalitarian and is more beneficial to the people rather than the few oligarchs who end up running these countries and end up setting foreign policy for the entire planet.
Brian, there are some hawks in Washington. They've been speaking of entering negotiations on Iran's missile program. Tehran, of course, has stated this missile program as a deterrent, it's non-negotiable. I mean, how can they ask for, talking about something else and, discussing another deal, whereas they have torpedoed the other one, JCPA that we're talking about. That's one thing. And also, basically, why should Iran negotiate its deterrence? No country would do that.
Yeah, I deplore how much money and resources of the countries of the world are spending on weapons, and I hate to see another weapon system, but I think we have to trace where is this coming from? Why? It's coming from the provocations of the United States, and you can't expect another country to disarm. Now, back on the 29th of last month, Antony Blinken, U.S. Secretary of State, announced sanctions against, more sanctions against Iran over its drone program, mm-hmm. and saying that the Iranian-made drones in the region are destabilizing the area, which that was only 2 months after the United States, in the city of Kabul, killed the Ahmadi family, a family of seven children, using a drone.
Yeah, exactly.
And thousands of people being killed. How the U.S. drones have been destabilizing Pakistan, Yemen,
exactly.
Afghanistan, and then to have the nerve, the absolute nerve, to say that these Iranian drones, much smaller program, are destabilizing. Perhaps that's true, but that's not for the United States to put sanctions on Iran over their drone program.
Yeah, exactly. And it was the U.S. drone that entered Iranian territorial waters, and Iran brought it down. Iran never did anything like that. Okay, and that right. We come to the end of this edition of The Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We had editor of The Veterans Today, Mike Harris, joining us from Phoenix, and political commentator and peace activist Brian Terror from Malloy. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN. Thank you.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام يا ابن آدم إذا رأيت ربك سبحانه يتابع عليك نعمه وأنت تعصيه فاحذره.
Imam Ali, peace be upon him, said, O son of Adam, when you see that your Lord, the Glorified, bestows his favors on you, while you are disobeying him, you should fear him.
Back, dear friends, it's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, the son of Abu Talib alayhi salam. So we find an interesting narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam, which really shows us the universal persona of the Imam. Now, this is found in Al-Irshad by Sheikh Mufid, Volume 1, Part 3, Chapter 53. Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam, in this passage, he talks about that which can save us in our lives. Of course, that which he himself inculcated in his universal persona, and something that can help us to create a universal.